Hi, I'm Michelle Shepard, host of Uncover Sharmini from CBC Podcasts. In 1999, 15-year-old Sharmini Anandaville disappeared on her way to a job that police believed didn't exist. 4 months later, her remains were found in a wooded ravine. I revisit the case that has stayed with me for over 20 years, ever since I first covered it as a cub crime reporter for the Toronto Star. You can find Uncover Sharmini on CBC Listen or on your favorite podcast app.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
worth the price of emissions, premiers are pushing Ottawa to delay the upcoming carbon tax increase. But Canada's natural resources minister says the price on carbon is here to stay, and he believes sticking to it will pay off.
Sick and tired. Federal leaders say Ottawa's relationship with Indigenous communities is paramount. Inuit leaders say if that's true, the feds should keep their promise to finally eliminate tuberculosis.
No uncertain terms. Russians knew Vladimir Putin would win another term as president. But an opposition politician in exile tells us voters still found a way to have their say.
What are they orchestrating? Researchers at the University of British Columbia believe they may have discovered a new population of killer whales living in the open ocean, and they're really living up to their name.
It's enough to give you night terriers. To test the legitimacy of a Toronto-based dog DNA testing company, a journalist does the hard work. She submits a sample of her own human DNA and finds out she's 40% Alaskan Malamute.
And roll credits. The closure of Winnipeg's Video King marks the end of an era you may have believed was already over. The King himself tells us why now was the time to abdicate. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that reflects on the long, rewinding road. The pressure is on the federal government to ditch an upcoming boost to the carbon tax. The tax is set to increase from $65 per ton to $80 per ton on April 1st. But seven provincial premiers have now called on Ottawa to delay or scrap the hike, and Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre has put forward two motions taking aim at the tax, both of which will come to a vote in Parliament this week. Here he is speaking in question period this afternoon.
While common sense conservatives are fighting to axe the tax, build the homes, fix the budget, and stop the crime, this prime minister is promising a cruel April Fool's Day joke, a 23% carbon tax hike on food, gas, and groceries. This at a time when the prime minister has forced 50 families in at CFB in Gagetown, military families, to go to food banks. 2 million Canadians every month going to those same food banks, 8,000 as part of a Facebook group where they share tips on eating out of dumpsters. Will the Prime Minister gain some compassion and some common sense and spike the hike?
But the Liberal government is not budging. Jonathan Wilkinson is the Minister of Natural Resources. We reached him in Hamburg, Germany.
Minister, I'll start with Saskatchewan because you've said that it is unacceptable, as your government has, that it is refusing to collect the tax, and you've said that there will be consequences. And you were discussing what those might be. What will those consequences be?
Well, as I have said, and you correctly characterized it, I do think it is unacceptable for a provincial premier to essentially say that he is going to violate one of the laws of the land. And I think it's a very odd message to send to the people who live in Saskatchewan that it's okay to essentially pick and choose which laws you abide by. But certainly in that context, there need to be consequences associated with those decisions. But I've also said that we want to make sure that we're thoughtful about what we do going forward. And so we are having those conversations as we speak. And we have not come to a determination, but I expect that we will in the relatively near term.
But of course, as you know, sir, Saskatchewan is not the only province that this is a problem for your government in. Seven provincial premiers are telling you that this increase is going to hurt their constituents, hurt Canadians financially, and they're asking you to at least delay it. So why are you still saying no when there's so many lined up against you?
Well, I'm very concerned that provincial politicians are actually playing politics with an issue that they have no basis for the arguments that they make. I mean, at the end of the day, all of the data shows, whether you look at the study done by the University of Calgary, you look at the PBO, you look at the University of Regina, and a range of other studies shows that 80% of families get more money back, and it actually works inverse to income. So people who live on modest incomes get the most money back. So what these folks are saying is make poor people poorer. At the end of the day, the only people who pay more than they actually get back in the rebate are people who have a 6,000 square foot house, drive a Hummer, and have a boat in their backyard. And those people should pay more. They are polluting more. So, you know, I think it's very disappointing that provincial politicians are playing politics. I think it's very disappointing that Mr. Polyev is effectively just lying to Canadians on this issue. He has no basis, no data, and he is simply lying.
Are you worried, though, that his message, whether you agree with it or not, is resonating with Canadians he's speaking to? And we know, we've mentioned in the introduction, our listeners just heard that they're going to put forward, Conservatives are, this week, on getting rid of the carbon tax altogether, or at least the increase that is coming on April 1st. Those motions are coming this week. So people might be agreeing with him across the country, regardless of whether you do or not.
Well, it's not a question of me agreeing to it. I mean, at the end of the day, facts are facts, and he has zero facts. I don't agree with somebody who's a liar, and he is a liar. At the end of the day, we need to do a better job of communicating to people so that they understand that the vast majority of Canadians get more money back than they pay. It is an affordability measure, but it's also an important measure on fighting climate change. Like, Mr. Polyev's plan for climate is to let the planet burn.
On the issue of communicating this, you've said a few times in this conversation and others that your government could do a better job of communicating what this is all about and what it really means in your view to Canadians. But the carbon tax has been around for years now. So why haven't you, your government, been able to convince more Canadians that this is working as it should?
Well, I think, to be honest with you, we probably didn't focus enough on affordability issues, in part because it was only in the last, you know, year and a half or so that those came really to the fore in the aftermath of, you know, COVID and then, you know, inflation and interest rates. And so I think it has become a more pressing concern. I think it's fair to say that the government should have been communicating more effectively on the affordability issue. And that includes, like, a lot of people just get this as a deposit in their bank account. They don't even know that it's a rebate associated with the carbon price. So we have some work to do. But as I say, the data is all on our side. It is all on our side.
As you know, though, sometimes it's not the data. It's the impression that people have or what people are feeling in their households as they look at their bank accounts. I will say the Bank of Canada governor said last fall, Tiff Macklem did, that the carbon tax's direct impact on inflation was, quote, relatively small, about 1/20th of price increases that people are seeing. But on the other hand, you have premiers, Newfoundland and Labrador Premier Andrew Furey saying people are worried. New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs saying the tax has been brutal on people in his province because it's driving up the cost of essentials. So they're hearing from constituents about how they're feeling. Wouldn't a delay help quell some of the concerns?
So again, I think it's important that we are communicating more effectively with Canadians. But, you know, as the price goes up, the rebate goes up. And it actually helps people who live on more modest incomes. To Premier Higgs, I mean, that's just silly. And I would challenge Premier Higgs to say that he's actually read any of the information on how the price on pollution works. People in politics should be responsible enough to at least be using facts and actually trafficking in the truth, not trafficking in things that are not true.
Ontario Premier Doug Ford, as you may have heard, says he believes voters are going to punish your government if you go ahead with this increase. He used the word annihilate, I believe, as he was making that point. Does that concern you?
I think that at the end of the day, as we get to the ballot box 18 months from now, that people will be looking for options that actually enable them to see a future that is an affordable one for their families, that actually will see a strong and growing economy in a world that is going to have to be a much lower carbon future, and a government that actually is addressing climate change in a thoughtful way. And I think we will put that forward. The option to the government that exists today for Canadians will be a party that actually is climate deniers, that actually has no plan for an economy that can thrive in a low-carbon world. and one that has no view about how to ensure that things are affordable. So I'm quite happy for that to be the comparison when we actually get to the polls.
So you're not worried?
I am very optimistic, and I am very comfortable that Canadians are thoughtful folks and will give this appropriate and due consideration as we actually move to the polls.
Minister Wilkinson, I appreciate your time. Thank you. Safe travels.
All right. Thanks very much.
Jonathan Wilkinson is the Federal Minister of Natural Resources. He's in Hamburg, Germany. If you believe the Russian Electoral Commission, it was an absolute landslide. Russian President Vladimir Putin was re-elected with 87.28% of the vote. It was the biggest victory in the post-Soviet era. But no credible election watchers believe the vote was fair in any way. The independent vote monitoring group Golos has called it the most corrupt in the country's history, which is saying something. Observers say Mr. Putin orchestrated the unbelievable result to establish a perception of widespread public support for the war in Ukraine and for the president himself in a country with no credible opposition figures. Dmitry Gudkov is a Russian opposition politician and former Duma member who lives in exile in Varna, Bulgaria. That's where we reached him.
Dmitry, we know across Russia yesterday, thousands of people did, you know, respond to the opposition call to stand silently in line at polling stations to protest this election in Russia. Obviously, that did not make a difference in the outcome. They expected that, I'm sure. But what did you think about what you saw, that kind of protest?
I think that it was very successful because all Russian elections are falsified and there is no opportunity to influence the results. So that's why we decided to organize this action known against Putin in order to let millions of people to be visible, to demonstrate their protest against Putin policy and against the war.
Just take us inside how this process works a little bit, because there were some other candidates on the ballot. Some of those other candidates presumably do get a little bit of support. You know, Putin didn't win 100% of the vote, certainly. How does it work? Why are those candidates there?
They just changed the ballots, for example, in different regions. For example, so we got some information from Observer, and at the polling stations, in the polling stations, for example, in Nizhny Novgorod, there was a result, for example, Putin received 400 votes. But officials then declared that Putin received more than 1,000 votes. So we have two papers and with the different results. So that's how it works. So we, unfortunately, we had no chance to maintain all polling stations with the observers. But in some of them, we had independent observers. And where the votes were counted fairly, Putin received from 40 to 60%, with the turnout, the maximum 50, 52, 53%.
Is there any mechanism at this point, after all of these years that Putin has been in power, is there any mechanism or way for Russians who disagree with Putin to actually make political change?
When the elites are homogeneous, for example, when they are united, there is no chance for the civil society to go against Putin, because it's very dangerous. For example, you can face the jail term up to 15 or even sometimes 25 years in jail, like it happened with Vladimir Karamurza. But I think this situation will result in the split of elite, because 90% of the Russian elites, they are not happy with what is going on. They are not happy with the Putin's policy. They don't support the
war.
Why?
What are they
unhappy
about? Some
of them are because they don't want Russia to be isolated. They didn't expect that Putin would wage the war against Ukraine, because the 90% of the Russian elites, they kept their money abroad. They send their children to study to Europe, to the United States, and now they lost of these opportunities. But unfortunately, while Putin is strong, they're unlikely to dare to go against him.
What and do you think there is going to be anything to split the elite in Russia? You know, there's some polling that says the New York Times is reporting. Really, it's maybe if there was another choice, people would take it. But that option is not on the table right now. And there's a lot of apathy across the country. That's a difficult thing to fight anywhere, right? That kind of apathy.
Of course, it's very difficult. But I think we need to unite efforts. I mean, to unite efforts with the European, with the Western politicians and lawmakers to boost the split. And I think that the capital flight could be $500 billion, for example.
So you're saying more sanctions, different kinds of sanctions would help?
I think that the sanctions should be corrected. So the sanctions should provide Russian people with the legal channels to withdraw money from Russia.
What do you think this election result will mean for the war in Ukraine?
Unfortunately, I predict the wave of repression against Russian people. But I think that new wave of mobilization will create new challenges for Putin. In case of mobilization, I think that the protest moods will skyrocket.
You had to flee Russia. Does this election result make the idea of returning to your country feel further away?
Of course, because I'm convicted in absentia, so I'm in the wanted list. So there is no way to come back to Russia right now. So it will be just the one-way road to the prison, not only for me, but for many Russians. And I think that the repression will be more tough after these so-called elections. So in case of some changes, in case of the split of elite, some mass protests, if it happens, for example, in the future, I think that many people, many politicians, many public figures, journalists will try to come back, of course, to Russia and to fight for changes.
Can you even imagine a time where Vladimir Putin is not leading Russia?
It's a very difficult question. So we hope that it will be not in the long haul. It will happen until 2030.
Till 2030, did you say?
Yeah, because he intends to run for presidency in 2030. And I hope that everything will happen earlier.
Dmitry, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
We reached Dmitry Gudkov in Varna, Bulgaria. There was a time when it was just what you did on a Friday night. You went to the store in person to rent a movie. Staring at the options, reading the review blurbs, and contemplating at length which Julia Roberts movie best suited your current mood. Swearing it would be different this time, you would return it on the due date and not rack up $41 in late fees. Mulling over whether to pay the extra $1.99 for a new release. No intrusive algorithm, just you versus the shelves. For most of us, that is a snapshot of the past, but not for clients of Video King. The Winnipeg Movie Rental Store has been in business for an impressive 40 years, but now owner Glenn Fuel has announced that he's closing up shop. We reached Mr. Fuel in Stonewall, Manitoba.
Glenn, we're speaking to you because it's sad for a lot of people that you're going to close, but it's also really remarkable you've been able to stay open this long. How were you able to do that?
Well, we're able to do that because of our network. We have a dealer network that we've had in the past of a distribution area of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and northwestern Ontario. And the base of the Transcona store is really the head office of the whole network.
Mm-hmm. When you say dealers, tell me what you mean.
Yeah, the dealers is like gas stations, mom-and-pop stores, grocery stores in small towns. We've been supplying entertainment to those towns for, well, some of them right up to almost 40 years already.
So what made you decide now is the time to shut down after all these decades?
Well, you know, it wasn't an easy decision, I can tell you that. COVID has definitely been a big part of it, with the Hollywood studios and directors and everybody on strike. Mm-hmm. No movies coming out. That really put the head in the nail in the coffin.
It's still fascinating that DVD, Blu-ray, or VHS, however you like to watch, that people were still renting movies. Did it surprise you?
No, it doesn't. Because, again, you got to remember, there's remote areas that don't have high-speed internet. And, you know, I was just in a small town prior to this one, and we were just talking that to the employees that there's still areas that just don't have that service.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting, you know, you mentioned the various strikes in Hollywood. I can see how that would be a hit to your business in terms of new content. But I wonder, I would think that that would drive more people to the shop because they can't get things on their streaming services. Maybe they'll rent an old movie they haven't seen. You didn't see any of that?
No, because here's the thing, right? Like the video business has always been driven by the new releases. 80% of our businesses was done on new releases.
Mm-hmm.
I was buying, back pre-COVID days, 36 titles a month. During COVID, of course, that slowed down quite a bit. Now with the Hollywood on strike, I bought 14 major titles in the year of 2023.
How have people been reacting?
You know, there's a lot of people that are disappointed. They understand. They totally get why I have to do this. You know, the last year has been a struggle just to keep everything at bay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, I'm not in this business to support it financially. I'm in this business to make money.
Yeah.
That's where we're at today.
You are near one of your retailers, or one of your dealers, I should say. You're near one of your dealers right now. What do they think about your plans to close up shop?
Well, you know, they understand. You know, I kind of talked to the owner of this store here a while back, and, you know, I'm just, again, it hurts for them, too, because they don't know what to put in the store. You know, I've gone to stores that, you know, over last year to 2 years that I've kind of gone to the point where we're not making any money, shook their hands and said, you know, I'm sorry, you're just not working no more. And the problem with them is they don't know what to put in that space. So to just put more Pepsi in the space that they already had Pepsi is not helping them in revenues.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't know what to put there.
And what about people? What do you say to people who don't have high-speed internet, that the streaming services aren't really the thing for them?
Well, you know, I feel for them because this is what's being driven is the hard disk is, you know, they kind of said to me, well, you know, what's the next format? And I really don't know. I don't believe there will be a next format. I really think the studios, you know, they're suffering too. The theaters are suffering. There has to be a real big shakeup on what's next, because if it's online, there ain't going to be no hard disk in the end.
You mentioned you're in this to make money, not a movie buff, I read, which is interesting in and of itself, because even if it's making money, that's a long time to dedicate to something that you really don't have strong feelings about.
Well, the strong feelings come from that I love being in business. And this was a good business to be appreciative about. Your servicing communities, you know, it's not just about supplying something. They're taking it home. They're with their families. Very important to people with families, of course. You know, it just, we're a part of that community, every community we were in.
So you're a bit sad to lose that, it sounds like.
It really is.
What are you going to do next?
Well, as you probably read, I'm a counselor for the Arm of Springfield, and that's another 2.5 years. This is my third term, so it's not something new. Semi-retirement is good. Of course, another thing is I have a poster collection of 122,000 posters. The plan there is to go through them eventually. They're on pallets. There's 10 pallets, about 13,000 posters.
Movie posters?
Movie posters, that's mm-hmm. correct.
So you're going to sell those?
And maybe that's a semi-retirement thing. We're still trying to work our way through this.
What, you know, there are film buffs listening, I'm sure, right now, and they're thinking, is there some stock I can get my hands on? Are you going to have a big sale?
Well, I've had a lot of people come in for posters. You know, they're looking for that specific ones, and like I say to them, leave their name and number and leave it with us, and eventually I'll get to this. There's the Titanic, there's Spider-Man, the list goes on. I have 7,500 titles.
That's a big semi-retirement project, Glenn. Good luck to you with that.
Well, you know, and I tell my kids that they're going to inherit it if I don't do anything with it, and they just kind of say, Dad, you got to deal with it before you die.
Well, let us know how that sorting goes. We've done a lot of conversations about surprises that come up in those kinds of archives. So maybe we'll speak again, Glenn. Thank you.
Thank you.
Glenn Fuel is the president and CEO of Video King in Winnipeg. The store will close in April. We reached him in Stonewall, Manitoba. I think it's safe to say that dogs don't care about their genealogy. They aren't running around the dog park sharing their 23andMe results. But their owners are a different breed. You may have noticed it's all some of them talk about. Mr. Snuggles is 17% hypoallergenic Balinese elephant dog and 83% super platinum retriever or whatever. They're often able to give you a more detailed rundown of their pet's family tree than their own. But is any of that real? Christina Hager had that question, so she put DNA My Dog to the test. The Boston-based investigative journalist recently submitted a sample of her own human DNA to the Toronto-based company, which claims to provide customers with the highest possible accuracy in determining a dog's breed. Ms. Hager sent the same sample to two other companies offering a similar service. Those companies analyzed Ms. Hager's DNA and reported her non-canine sample did not yield a reliable result. But somehow, DNA My Dog found Ms. Hager was 40% Alaskan Malamute, 35% Sharpei, and 25% Labrador. Ruh-roh. The numbers add up, but nothing else does. Now, last week, DNA My Dog's director told Global News, quote, "It's unfortunate that the accuracy of our canine DNA test has been called into question," unquote. It's also unfortunate, they went on to admit, they used an algorithm that may, quote, "randomly associate non-canine genetic sequences with canine ones," unquote. Unfortunate, yeah. Apparently, that algorithm has been abruptly phased out. But regardless, DNA My Dog's business model might be pooched.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Things were supposed to be better by now. In 2018, the federal government pledged to eliminate tuberculosis across Inuit regions by 2030. It also promised to cut infection rates by half by 2025. But TB persists in Inuit communities with barely any change in the number of people getting sick. So with the federal budget just weeks away, advocates are looking for action. Natan Obed is the president of the Inuit Tapirit Kanatami. We reached him in Ottawa.
Natan Obed, what do you tell other leaders in Ottawa, political leaders, when you want to impress upon them the impact TB has on Inuit?
Well, first, just from a policy perspective, this is a preventable public health crisis, and our rate of TB is over 300 times the rate of Canadian-born non-Indigenous people. And so I talk about the fact that we have already committed to this work. We have recognized how important this work is in ensuring that Inuit can live healthy, prosperous lives. And we also know the foundations that cause the elevated rate, and it is within our power to act upon reducing them.
What is causing that elevated rate? Why hasn't it come down?
Well, we have historically high rates of TB going back from the 1950s. We have overcrowding rates within our homes of over 50% in comparison to under 10% in non-Indigenous households in this country. We have higher rates of poverty and higher rates of food insecurity. And if you don't have proper nutrition, if you're not able to meet those standard levels of need when it comes to your diet and your ability to take care of yourself and your family, then you are at more risk for tuberculosis. And we also don't understand the disease in the best possible way to treat Inuit. So there is a research component that we need to continue to work on. to ensure that any of the healthcare provisions that are allocated to this issue are all working in sync with what we know about how TB affects Inuit. We have the lowest rate of medical doctors per capita in the country in Inuit Nunavut. We have very little capacity to treat anyone with active TB in our small communities. And all of these things compound into the rates that we see today.
When the next federal budget arrives, what kind of pathways, what kind of funding, money do you want to see in it to finally tackle this problem in its entirety?
In ITK's 2024 pre-budget submission, we've requested a total of $131.6 million over 7 years to specifically work on the public health aspects, the TB elimination aspects of this from a healthcare perspective and from a community health perspective. We also have corresponding requests in for a national Inuit Nunavut school food program. We have a request in for a 10-year strategic investment in housing and more largely in infrastructure. These things cost money, but they are the pathways to the elimination of tuberculosis. And if the federal government has other pathways that they imagine to meeting the goal of elimination by 2030, they haven't told us yet.
We know the government is under certainly a lot of pressure. Departments are being told to trim expenses. There's pressure to spend more on defense, on pharmacare as well, as we know. So how are you feeling about your chances of getting all of that funding that you're asking for?
Not one federal minister or the prime minister has indicated that the funding that is necessary for tuberculosis elimination will be allocated in this year's budget. That is as cold and hard a truth as I could ever convey. On the other side, on the intention side or the hopeful side, we have ministers like Minister Haidu and Minister Ananda Sangari, also the Prime Minister, who have said again and again that no relationship is more important than the one that it has with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis in this country. I would hate for the clock to run out on this government, and especially in the next year and a half, without the government of Canada stepping up into something that it has pledged to do for Inuit, that is a preventable crisis in this country, and one that we have a very clear path on how to solve.
Do you know anyone personally who's had TB?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my son, when he was a year and a half, contracted latent TB from another one of his peers in daycare and from one of the daycare providers. This is a disease that impacts almost everyone who lives in Inuit Nunavut. And I also know people who have passed away as adults, not as elderly people, and some people who are quite young who have passed away as well. This is an active crisis in our communities, and TB is not a disease to be trifled with. It is unfortunate that sometimes the considerations that the government has about what a crisis is and how to then focus on eliminating our crisis is a completely different equation for Inuit and our public health issues or our healthcare outcomes than it is for other crises in other parts of the world or other crises here in the country. It just seems like the government of Canada is willing to let these crises stand as a form of dysfunctional status quo when other parts of the countries, if this was the case, there would be immediate and widespread political action and resources allocated to eliminating the public health crisis.
Nathan Obed, thank you for your time.
Always happy to be on the show.
Nathan Obed is the president of the Inuit Tapirit Kanatami. He's in Ottawa. Thank you. great white sharks used to be thought of as the ocean's apex predator. But it turns out they might be the equivalent of that guy in high school who seemed tough because he had a switchblade comb. It turns out the real tough guys might be orcas. There was a recent account of orcas mercilessly hunting and killing great whites, and several frightening recent stories of groups of orcas attacking and sinking entire yachts with people on board. And now new research by scientists at the University of British Columbia. In the study, published in the journal Aquatic Mammals, they say they've potentially identified a new pod of 49 orcas living far off the coast of California and Oregon that are showing unique killer instincts even for killer whales. Andrew Treitz is a co-author of the study. We reached him in Vancouver.
Andrew, what was the first sign to you and your team that this group of orcas might be an entirely new population?
Well, the first sign was the fact that we had a box of photographs that we couldn't match up with any known killer whale. And that got us wondering, like, who are these animals? And ultimately realized that these unknown animals shared a number of different characteristics.
It's exciting to make any new discovery. I mean, I've had enough conversations with scientists on the program to know that, certainly, without being an expert. But what in particular about this pod of orcas excites you and your team?
Well, first, there was 9 sightings of 49 individuals. And some of the sightings, well, one was like over 500 kilometers from land. It's literally out, way out in the open ocean. And we noticed a couple of things about them. One is that they were all feeding on marine mammals, although one of the encounters involved eating a sea turtle. We also noticed that in terms of trying to identify them, they had dorsal fin shapes and their saddle patches that looked somewhat similar to the transiformic killer whales that we know are marine mammal specialists, but they also had some characteristics that looked like another ecotype that we call offshores that specialize in eating sharks and large fish. So they weren't a perfect fit for either group. And then a third thing that stood out that made them quite different is that almost every one of these individuals had distinct cookie-cutter shark marks, where a cookie-cutter shark had come and removed a chunk of flesh, literally like it was punching out a cookie. And those sharks only live in tropical waters.
So what does that tell you?
It tells us that these killer whales are spending time in tropical water, but also coming further north. We don't know how far north they go ultimately, because these encounters have been purely by chance. No one went out looking for killer whales here. They were found by accident. Pictures were taken. Those pictures were then sent to killer whale specialists, one of whom is the lead author of this paper, Josh McInnes, who's a graduate student with me. And his job was to match it up, and he couldn't. And it led him to wonder, so what's unique about these? And then we began to realize there was a pattern.
That must have been exciting in the lab.
It's so exciting. And then we say, what if, and what's the possibility? So at the end of the day, we're still putting out here as a hypothesis. Mm-hmm. We're proposing that they are a unique group, possibly a subpopulation of what we call the transient killer whales, or possibly a totally unique population, which could be the oceanic population.
You mentioned the leatherback turtle that the whales had eaten. The diet overall, I mean, certainly the circle of life is playing out quite vividly under the sea, but this group of orcas in particular are preying on a lot of different things.
They are. They're preying on everything from this sea turtle to rhesus dolphins, sperm whales, an elephant seal. They're taking species which we know live in the open ocean, far, far from land. And it points also to the fact that out there in what I think is being the last frontier, we have a lot of life there that is poorly understood and poorly known. And these killer whales are giving us some insight into the productivity of a poorly understood and poorly studied piece of the ocean.
So that diet, is it different than the traditional orca diet?
In some ways, yes, but in other ways, no. So we know that killer whales have very high energy requirements, so they have to feed on species that are very high in lipid, so that automatically points to marine mammal species as well as to some of the fish species, such as Chinook salmon, or even sharks that are just full of oil in their livers. So we see that similarity. But the fact that their diet of, for example, the sperm whales, is not something that we've seen here. It's been seen in other places of the world. But again, tells us that these animals clearly have specialized in trying to capture and kill marine mammals and sea turtles, too, it appears, that live in the open ocean.
You mentioned the photographs that were taken. Who took those photos?
The photos come from different sources, and so it's pretty common on any trip that a biologist will have a camera. And so what's typical when people are, when they see killer whales, first they know it's a killer whale, they just don't know who it is. And so they may take pictures, and then they will send it in to someone like Josh McInnes or others and say, hey, can you tell us who we saw? And that's where the moment of discovery starts, when normally it's possible to match them up because we now have catalogs and most of the individuals are now known. But here we've got a small group that nobody knows who they are.
Orcas, you know, there's still more to learn, certainly, but they are very well researched generally when we talk about species in the Pacific Ocean. Why do you think it's taken this long to discover this group?
Well, I think even if you look at the history of killer whale research in British Columbia, which has been the motherland of killer whale research, at the beginning when killer whales were being removed for aquariums, there was a thinking that there were just tens, if not hundreds of thousands of them. And we assumed there was just one type of killer whale called a killer whale. And in fact, it was by doing careful observations that we began to piece together the fact that there were distinct populations that either specialized in eating fish or specialized in eating marine mammals or specialized in eating sharks. But it took a long time to discover that. And even with the ones that we now feel, as a matter of fact, we know them well, we're still making new discoveries and there's still more to learn about them. But they certainly do capture people's imaginations. There's a lot of concern about their well-being because the numbers are low and they do face threats. And they're being carefully monitored. But it does seem that the more time we spend with them, looking at them, we begin to realize there's more intricacies to their lives than what any of us can ever imagine.
Andrew, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew Troitz is the director of the Marine Mammal Research Unit at the University of British Columbia. We reached him in Vancouver. In 2021, a Malawian activist living in New Hampshire saw a Facebook post from another Malawian woman describing the terrible abuse she was facing as a domestic worker in Oman. The activist quickly created a WhatsApp group to help her, and it wasn't long before she discovered dozens of other women in the same situation. Now the operators of an Athens-based charity called Do Bold have helped that activist extricate more than 50 women from abusive working conditions. Their efforts are the subject of a new BBC documentary. Ekaterina Porras-Sivolobova is the founder and director of Do Bold. We reached her in Athens.
Ekaterina, you have been doing this work for years now, a decade, if I'm not mistaken, or so. What are some of the most common forms of abuse that you see that these women are facing?
Something that we see throughout, very common on the women, is not having a day off. So basically they are working 7 days a week, and this is not an exaggeration. And the average hours that they work, because there are no laws that restrict the maximum hours that they work, we find them working in average 16 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And these are the common things, including also the passport retention. I think these are the three most common things that we see.
And what kinds of homes or businesses are the women working for?
They mostly work for Omani families. Mm-hmm. Which usually they are large families. Culturally, they have large families, so the houses are big. There is plenty of work, unfortunately, for one person, and this is how they spend their time. They take care of children, of the cooking, of the cleaning, and if they have elderly, including the elderly, where we find that many of them that are taking care of the elderly actually have to sleep in the same room.
And are they told about any of this before they arrive?
So in this, we see that some actually do know that they are coming to work as domestic workers. Of course, the working conditions are different as to what actually is, especially from the salary perspective. They are not told actually, you know, what they're coming to. But we also see that some of them don't even know that they're actually coming to Oman. Mm.
They're lied to.
Yes, they are deceived. They are deceived. They are told that they're going to work in a restaurant in Dubai. Dubai is a common country that they use to lure the women. And until the ticket is bought, then they actually realize that they are coming to Oman.
And what kind of wages are they promised, and what do they actually get?
For Malawian women, it has been promised about double than what they are getting, which is about $800 a month, mm-hmm. Double than what they actually get.
They're so promised they 800 getting, and they only get 4.
Right, between 300 and mm-hmm. 400. Of course, some of them are victims of wage theft, so not necessarily they get everything.
How, in the end, you know, the 50 women that the BBC focused on in their reporting, how did you help secure their release?
The release process, it involves negotiation, mm-hmm. Negotiating with their employers for them to be allowed to go home. And this is because the domestic workers are not allowed to leave the country by law. The reason why we have to negotiate is because they ask for money, and we want to negotiate to zero, because this is what is fueling human trafficking, exploitation in Oman. Now, with the Malawian women, it's a little bit different than what we would normally do. The Malawian government had funds to pay this money, which we call release money, and that meant they were able to pay anything from $1,000 to $2,000 per woman to the employer, plus the flight ticket. Mm-hmm. So our role was basically at this point first to see if we can negotiate the least money possible according to the amount of time that she had been working, mm-hmm. whether there was any salary missing. We want to make sure that that is considered as well, and make sure that the women are safe during the whole process, because some of the employers might be upset that actually their worker reached out to their government.
What was it like to see? I mean, it's quite emotional from just what I was reading and seeing in the BBC coverage. But what is it like for you, for someone who works in this field, to see them get back to their homes and safe?
Yes, I mean, this is the best moment. We often don't realize, or we forget actually how how their lives is affected, and not only their lives, but actually their whole families, their children. A lot of them are mothers. So seeing the children, hearing the children, hearing the mother thanking us for what we were able to do for their daughter. I mean, it puts things into perspective, mm-hmm. and remind us of, why we are doing this. So it's a very emotional time.
You're in contact with other women, I know, and not just in Oman, I know that, but, you were mentioning it's illegal for these workers to leave. They hand over their passports, they sign up to work. Why is that illegal for them to leave?
Yes, so taking the passport, it is not legal, although we are still yet to see any document that says so. The Oman government states that it is not legal. It is a common practice and nobody is held accountable. So that is what is happening. Now, the women are not allowed to leave the house. There are laws in Oman that says, okay, this is your employer and this is who you work with or for, and as a domestic worker, you have to live in your employer's home. Even if they know what are their rights, there is so little that they can do. So we need to make sure that if there is something that can be done, we do it. These are directly with the workers in WhatsApp groups for them to understand what is their situation, because a lot of them do not know actually what are the laws. Mm-hmm. We try to see if we can ask her to stay while we negotiate with the employer, because once she leaves the employer's house, then she has committed a crime, no matter what was her working situation.
we mentioned we are reaching you in Greece. You used to do this work in Oman, but you left in 2019. Why did you have to leave?
Right. It was for security reason. Mm-hmm. I was not able to continue my work, and also I wouldn't be able to do what I do now.
Ekaterina, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ekaterina Poras-Sivilobova is the founder and director of Do Bold. We reached her in Athens. Earlier in the show, we talked to the owner of Video King in Winnipeg about his decision to shut down his movie rental shop after 40 years in business. It's the kind of news that makes you go, wait, there was still a video rental store operating in Winnipeg? But it's also the kind of news that makes us want to peruse the offerings in the As It Happens archives. Like this here, come on. How many times do I have to tell you people to rewind the tapes? I'll just wind it back by hand here. As I tell you, Video King may be among the last of its kind, but it wasn't entirely alone. In 2018, we talked to Sandy Harding, manager of the Bend, Oregon Blockbuster Video. She spoke with guest host Laura Lynch right after her store became the last Blockbuster in the United States.
Ms. Harding, how does it feel to be the general manager of the last remaining Blockbuster in America?
Oh my gosh, it is so exciting and so much fun. And, you know, we never thought this day would come where we would be the last standing. We really, truly thought the Alaska stores were going to outlast us. And so this has just been a lot of fun and super exciting.
So you were aware that there were these other two stores up in Alaska. What was your reaction when you found out they were closing?
Shocked, a little sad. Every time one of the stores closes, you know, it's a little closer to the end of the era. So it's really sad for us. Of course, I know the rest of the country has already felt that end because a lot of the stores had closed down ahead of time. And over the last couple of years, I know they've just dwindled down to nothing, obviously, since we're the last one. But, you know, it is sad. But, it's so exciting to know that we've done it, that we've held out and we've lasted doing what we always do and giving the great service we always give. And you know, it's just exciting knowing that we've made it.
No, but I understand the person who owns the Bend Blockbuster also owned two others in Oregon, but they've also closed. So what is it that keeps Bend's Blockbuster going?
You know, we just have always had tremendous community support here, and we have a lot of regular local customers that come in, and they know they can get that same wonderful customer service. We haven't changed our prices. They know that we're
since when?
You know, here consistent.
You haven't changed your prices since when?
Oh, my gosh. We haven't changed prices since Dish Network closed all the Blockbusters. So last 7 or 8 years, we've been the same prices. And you know, that was one of the things that we've been able to maintain, and which most people are shocked by. But I think it just came from cutting costs in other places so that we could keep our customers coming in and knowing that this was still a value.
So how much is it going to cost me to rent The Godfather?
You're going to laugh, 99 cents per week.
Oh, that's a deal.
It is a deal. And we have other ones that are $1.99, and then our new releases are $3.99 for anything from 3 nights to a week. The newest stuff, obviously, is the 3 nights, and after about 2 or 3 weeks, it goes to a week rental. And then we charge a nominal late fee. It's 49 cents a day if you keep it out past that week. Gone are the days of, you know, re-renting it every day for the, you know, until eternity, and you have $100 worth of late fees.
For anybody who has nostalgic memories of visiting a Blockbuster, is there anything different about your store?
No. We still operate the same computer system we have the entire time. It's still in 1990s. It still has floppy disks. we, you know, still are blue and yellow. We still have the same Blockbuster signs out front. You know, kids still wear blue and yellow T-shirts and their, you know, Blockbuster name tags that are the ticket. And, you know, nothing's changed. You come in here and it still looks like a Blockbuster store out of the 90s.
How can you still use floppy disks in computers that old?
Well, you know, at the time when Dish Network closed the stores, we weren't really sure what the status of the stores were going to be. And so it became a cost issue. And so we ended up kind of maintaining those old computer systems simply because we couldn't afford at the time to change to the new ones, to a new system, and we weren't sure exactly what our future was going to hold. And then after a while, it became a nostalgia thing. I mean, it's a conversation piece. When people come in and see IBM, on the computers, it definitely is. So.
You say that the computers are a conversation piece. The whole store is a conversation piece. People come by just to take pictures?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this was happening prior to Thursday when Alaska announced that they were closing. We would still have people lined up and wanting to take pictures in front of the store. And just because we're in Bend, and Bend is a tourist town, and so, you know, we have people traveling in all the time and see that we're still open, and they're like, oh my gosh, there's a Blockbuster store. And they come in, and the first question is, how are you still here? Why are you still here? How could you possibly be still operating? So it is definitely a conversation piece with every customer that walks in the door.
And how busy are you right now?
We're pretty busy. I'm pretty tired. We've been going strong for several days now, and lots of people coming in to visit, and it's pretty wonderful to have this influx of new customers coming in the door again. A lot of local people who have forgotten we're here, and the media coverage has been wonderful. It's been getting people back in.
So considering the store's success, what do you think the chances are there might be a Blockbuster revival?
You know, that would be, I would have a hard time thinking that's going to happen, because there really is no Blockbuster. There's no Blockbuster corporate. There's no one to sign a licensing or a franchise agreement with. And Dish Network owns the rights to the name, so that would be 100% up to them if they would want to invest in reopening Blockbuster. I would have a hard time thinking that that's going to be a chance, but you never know. With all the, you know, people and all the nostalgia, who knows?
Can you tell me if you know anything about this rumor that I've heard that your owner might turn the Ben's Blockbuster into a museum if the business doesn't work out?
You know, what is so funny is that we've actually had customers calling and telling us that. And he, it's just funny because he knew that I had told him that customers were calling and saying, hey, if you ever close the store, make sure to turn it into a museum. And so he had made a comment about that, you know, if the day ever does come that we have to close, maybe we'll do that. And I think that's where the rumor started from. I don't think that that's our end game. Our end game is to stay open as long as we possibly can, but who knows what could possibly happen.
All right, Sandy, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. You have a wonderful day, and thanks for thinking of us.
Bye-bye.
From our archives, that was Blockbuster store manager Sandy Harding speaking with guest host Laura Lynch. The Bend, Oregon store is now the last Blockbuster in the world. Dateline Rome. How you respond to being given Joseph Stalin's bed as a gift says a lot about you as a person. Most of us would not accept. We certainly would not give it pride of place in the guest room. But former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi was not known for his taste. Not for his good taste, anyway. Vladimir Putin gave him Stalin's bed as a touching, weird token of their friendship. And Mr. Berlusconi had it installed in Palazzo Grazioli, his residence in Rome for 25 years. A place where he could meet with foreign dignitaries, make big political decisions, and when the pressure became too intense, invite a few close friends over for a rejuvenating bunga bunga party. What he did not do there was talk to foreign journalists, because he said all foreign newspapers were offensive. But as of last June, Silvio Berlusconi and Stalin's bed, I assume, are gone. And a week from today, journalists with Rome's Foreign Press Association are moving in. Now, one member of the board told The Guardian that the association had been struggling to find a new home. Gustav Hofer said, I joked with the property broker, how about Berlusconi's ex-home? And he took it seriously and said, let me look into it. And, you know, it turns out it was available. And Mr. Hofer says the Palazzo retains, quote, the spirit of Berlusconi, unquote. I'm sure a good steam cleaning will take care of that. But, oh, I guess he probably means Mr. Berlusconi's spiritual essence. That must feel odd. And it is definitely odd that the reporters he found so offensive will be working in the very palazzo where he worked. But, you know, as we've established, politics makes strange bedfellows. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.